Well, the thing is, he is such a dude. We can't believe how much he helped my mother. I mean, you took away her pain like magic. So, you know.
Okay, welcome to tonight's third class in our four-week mini-series on the yoga of Jesus. Tonight we're going to cover the general topic of whether Jesus' teachings were the way, one way, to get to spirituality, and there was only one way, or whether they were part of a universal spiritual teaching tradition. So we're going to question is whether Jesus intended those teachings to be defining a unique route to attaining reunion with the divine, or whether they're extensions to and built on the Eastern mystical tradition and its accompanying universality that we've looked at the last couple of weeks in terms of that comparison we've been doing there. We'll do this by taking a look at three teachings that are often cited by mainstream Christians as evidence of the uniqueness of Jesus' teachings. These are often what we call proof texts that convince or attempted to convince non-believers that Christianity is the only way to get to heaven. We'll begin by looking at Jesus' teachings on the notion of rebirth. And then we'll take a look at a portion of a story about Nicodemus, about whether baptism is essential to entering into the kingdom, and if so, what that baptism means. And finally, we'll conclude with an examination of the question of whether belief in the only begotten Son of God is required or even sufficient to attain enlightenment or salvation, whatever we want to call that last step in the process. For the first two sections on your outline of this evening's study, we're going to be revisiting the story of Nicodemus. But we must begin with a re-examination of the need for Jesus to teach all except his disciples using the form of presentation called parables. A parable, you'll recall from earlier studies, is a succinct didactic story. Didactic means teaching story. In prose or verse, which illustrates one or more instructive lessons or principles. Parables are generally different from fables in that parables use human characters and fables use animal characters. Other than that, they're very similar to each other in terms of their purpose and their construction. Parables were in common use throughout Israel at the time of Jesus lived. They were a teaching vehicle frequently used by many of the itinerant rabbis who made up the informal fabric of teaching to the lower classes. Lower classes often couldn't get to the synagogue or didn't go because they couldn't make a donation or whatever, and they were served, that group was served by itinerant rabbis who floated around and went into communities and held informal gatherings and so forth, and Jesus was one of those later in his career. Now, Jesus is reported to have told his disciples that the reason he taught in parables when addressing the masses of people trying to follow him was because of their unawareness. And let's see, I'll read you this citation from the scripture here. So this is from Matthew 13, sort of verse 10. And his disciples came up and said to him, "Why do you instruct them only in parables?" In response, he said to them, "You have been given the privilege of knowing the secrets of heaven's imperial rule, but that privilege has not been granted to anyone else. That's why I tell them parables, because when they look, they don't really see, and when they listen, they don't really hear or understand." Furthermore, Jesus tells us in the next verse, this behavior was a fulfillment of a prophecy from Isaiah, which reads, "You listen closely, yet you won't ever understand. And you look intently, but you won't ever see. For the mind of this people has grown dull, and their ears are hard of hearing, and they have shut their eyes. Otherwise, they might actually see with their eyes, and hear with their ears, and understand with their minds, and turn around, and I would heal them." So that's God speaking to Israel through Isaiah and the Hebrew Scriptures on the subject. Interestingly, this interaction with the disciples, where he tells them that he reasonably teaches in parables, is because the people aren't prepared to hear the the wholeness of the truth, appears to support the main contention of the Gnostic approach to Christianity, if you think about it. Gnosticism says there's knowledge and then there's hidden knowledge or secret knowledge, which isn't revealed to everybody. You have to go through certain processes, rituals, trainings. There's all sorts of different names for that, what precedes it. But something precedes your exposure to the deeper teachings because you're not prepared to receive them until you've gone through that. And that's the idea behind Gnosticism. And this whole idea that Jesus talks about here is very Gnostic, isn't it? I mean, it's like they're not ready to hear this. They're not. Their ears aren't tuned to me. Their minds are not prepared. I just can't ask them in here to do this. Now, that can seem fairly elitist when it comes to spiritual teachings, because we sort of assume that any truth that's out there about God, the divine, that category of teachings should be readily accessible to everyone. There shouldn't be any secret keeping when it comes to religious matters. That to do so is to be elitist and to be exclusionary and therefore you're not really teaching from a perspective of universal love. But in reality, it's more like any other topic on which one wishes to become educated. There are often prerequisites, right? I mean, you wouldn't go to try to teach calculus to somebody who hadn't yet studied geometry. Right? You wouldn't try to teach analytical chemistry to somebody who hadn't studied organic chemistry, who hadn't studied inorganic chemistry. There are prerequisites for all kinds of learning, and it's interesting to me that we tend to think that for religious learning, that shouldn't be the case. But the fact is, the religious learning is among the hardest learning because so much of it is subjective and inner-drawn that it's difficult. It's difficult to transcend ego and transcend the material to get some of these deep spiritual ideas. As Yogananda puts it, the ultimate truths of heaven and the kingdom of God can only be grasped by intuition, awakening the intuitive knowing, the pure comprehension of the soul. So we make contact with religious and spiritual teachings through that process of inner communion through meditation. So now let's look at the story of Nicodemus, which may or may not be a parable, but at least it has some of the characteristics of one, and see what we can learn from a deeper reading of that material. So I'm going to read the story from, and we're dealing with it in a couple of different bites, so I'm going to read them in individual chunks. And I'm reading from the Complete Gospels, which is a scholar's version of this material. I wonder why I didn't. I'm reading the wrong page.
Yes.
So this is from John chapter 3. A Pharisee named Nicodemus, a Judean leader, came to Jesus during the night and said, "Rabbi, we know that you've come as a teacher from God. After all, nobody can perform the miracles you do unless God is with him." Jesus replied to him, "As God is my witness, no one can experience God's imperial rule without being reborn from above." Keep that phrase in mind, reborn from above. Nicodemus says to him, "How can an adult be reborn? Can you re-enter your mother's womb and be born a second time?" Jesus replied, "As God is my witness, no one can enter God's domain without being born of water and spirit. What is born of the human realm is human. What is born of the spiritual realm is spirit. Don't be surprised that I told you, every one of you must be reborn from above. The spirit blows every which way, like wind. You hear the sound it makes, but you can't tell where it's coming from or where it's headed. That's how it is with everyone reborn in the spirit." Now, Yogananda describes the 21 verses in this story, and I've just read you the first 8. I said we'll deal with this in a couple chunks. Says he describes his 21 verse piece in John of the story of Nicodemus, and that's the only gospel in which this story appears. He says that those verses, quote, present Jesus' comprehensive esoteric teachings relating to the practical attainment of the infinite kingdom of blissful divine consciousness. So the story of Nicodemus is, in Yogananda's view, a Reader's Digest condensed version of the whole message. And this, what I just read to you, Nicodemus is described as a Judean leader, which probably means he was a Pharisee. quite likely part of the Judaic ruling body, the Sanhedrin, although he may have been what they call the masters of the temple. He comes to Jesus by night because of the social harm he might well incur if his interactions with a rebel rabbi were known. Jesus is not the most popular guy in the Jewish community at that point. But he introduces his dialogue with a very familiar ploy used by the Judaic leaders in all three synoptic gospels. He flatters Jesus. He says, remember, Rabbi, we know that you've come as a teacher from God. After all, nobody can perform the miracles you do unless God is with him. And all of the three synoptic gospels have a very similar construction, but on every occasion when it's used there, it's followed immediately by the Pharisees or the whoever the leaders are that are involved, or we don't always know, asking whether the Jewish people are obligated to pay the Roman tax. That's a practice that many Jews found idolatrous because Roman coins had the emperor's face on them. So they didn't want to engage in it. They felt that was being disloyal to their God, to Yahweh. So the question, they were trying to trap Jesus with this question. So you're the great wisdom teacher, keeper here. What should we do about paying our taxes to the Romans? And he had the same answer for all of them, of course. So from this introduction, we can't tell whether Nicodemus is sincere or not. Maybe he's trying to trap Jesus again. But at least he asked Jesus a question, a follow-up question that doesn't appear to be designed as a trap. Because after Jesus says to him, as God is my witness, no one can experience God's imperial rule without being reborn from above, he asks, how can an adult be reborn? He doesn't ask about the taxes. So it seems like he's an honest seeker. Yogananda says Nicodemus is a spiritual person who, quote, reverently affirmed his conviction that only a master who had actual God communion could work the super laws that govern the inner life of all beings and all things. And he also points out that the use of the word miracles in verse 2 has another level of meaning. He declares that the greatest miracle comes in the healing of what he calls the root cause of every form of suffering, the delusive ignorance that obscures the unity of man, soul, and God. In other words, that belief in separation that we talk about a lot in unity. Very much in keeping with the teachings of A Course in Miracles there. Yogananda goes on to say that all bona fide revealed religions of the world are based on intuitive knowledge. He says all religions have two aspects, the exoteric and the esoteric. The exoteric is the public perspective, the one that's seen by all the masses and anybody who wants to come into contact with the religion. And it focuses on public behavior. For the most part, ethics. The esoteric aspect focuses on actual communion of the soul with God and is only intended for consumption by those who have gone through an initiation process of some sort or achieved a certain state or level. So from this perspective, this second birth that we're talking about is the means by which we're enabled to enter the land of intuitional perception and truth. Since Nicodemus hasn't asked a question, Jesus' answer in verse 3 is strangely out of context. Right? Nicodemus says, I know you must be coming from God, and Jesus answers him, but he answers him like he asked a question. There is sort of an implicit question in his probe, though, isn't there? Are you really? Are you for real? And so Jesus talks about the kingdom within, and you have to be reborn from above to experience it. This sparks a confused response from Nicodemus, who asks, logically enough, if you take Jesus literally, how in the world could this happen? Can you re-enter your mother's womb and be born a second time, he asks. Jesus gets a little exasperated with Nicodemus at that point. Nicodemus, after all, is a leader of the Jewish community. He should know some of these basic teachings that Jesus is offering here. He starts out by saying, as God is my witness. He uses that phrase twice in this section of the story we're reading tonight. You could translate that in today's vernacular as something like, are you serious? Or perhaps even, oy vey. He clarifies his point, though, by saying no one can enter God's domain without being born of water and spirit. What is born of the human realm is human, but what is born of the spiritual realm is spirit. Returning to his original statement, Jesus reminds Nicodemus that he said it was necessary to be reborn from above. Okay, I want you to remember now to attach that reborn to this spiritual rebirth. Because we're going to tie the other side of that equation up in a minute to something you're not going to expect. It's probably worth noting here that when Jesus mandated that being, quote-unquote, born again was a prerequisite to enlightenment, that very choice of words could be seen as a reference, at least, to his familiarity with the doctrine of reincarnation. Not to say he taught it, not to say he approved of it, not to say he commented on it, but at least there's a possibility that in using that phrase, he was acknowledging that he was aware of it. So when Jesus says to Nicodemus that a person must be born of water, he does not mean baptism. At least according to Yogananda, he doesn't, and I'm inclined to agree with him after a significant amount of study on this. Water, Yogananda says, means the protoplasm from which we are born, what we are when we're initially formed. It refers to the physical birth of men and women. Jesus' teaching here in that context says, physical birth is not sufficient for us to be allowed to see or enter into the realm of God. Physical birth alone is not sufficient. Just because you became a human doesn't give you any right to do anything in the spiritual realm. You're still in the human realm. Of course, modern Christianity has taken this same verse to mean baptism as a prerequisite to salvation because it suits their needs. This position that mainstream Christianity, particularly evangelical Christianity, takes has led to all sorts of mischief, including the running battle over whether baptism can be successfully employed to bring uncomprehending infants and children into the kingdom. Battles continue to rage today among various denominations of Christianity about that one. And the related argument that led to the creation in the 4th century CE of the doctrine of original sin, from which only baptism could save us. Without original sin, there was no need for baptism, at least not for infants. So that got dragged into this whole discussion about this one passage in the teachings from the story of Nicodemus that it was, in my view now at least, having been persuaded by Yogananda and other research, that was not the original intent at all. Taking Yogananda and his inspired interpretation of this text to be accurate, however, we can reach a higher meaning. Perhaps what Jesus intended us to understand here is that given the limitations of our physical senses and even of our rational minds, without a spiritual rebirth, we can never realize the divine within us. Not because we're wrong, we're sinful, we're bad, we were born in original sin, but because we're limited to this body and these minds, these brains, which have a limited capacity to experience. We only have 5 senses. There's all sorts of other things going on in the universe around us that we can't detect. Thus, a physical birth through the medium of water, which comprises 97% of our bodies, falls short of the ability to understand and integrate spiritual concepts that we actually can attain only through spiritual intuition. And that spiritual intuition, of course, can only be attained through the practice of scientific meditation. Attaining this spiritual intuition through meditation also places a requirement on us humans to engage in our own conscious evolution. As you recall from last week's lesson, there are 5 stages or aspects to consciousness embodied in the evolutionary process when it's viewed from a physical perspective. Beginning with the unconscious response in minerals, we gradually evolve our power of knowing through the feeling present of plant life, the instinctive sentiment knowledge in animals, intellect and undeveloped introspective intuition in man, and pure intuition in the Superman. So we have these 5 stages of awareness that go along with the 5 physical stages of consciousness that we talked about last week. I would be happy to do that. So we start. If you start, minerals are their awareness in the evolutionary process is unconscious response. Plants have feeling. Feeling is present in plants. That's what he taught. Instinctive sentiment is what animals have, instincts. for the most part, of what they're governed by. Humanity is governed by intellect and undeveloped introspective intuition. And then pure intuition governs the Superman. That is the attainment, the part, the version of us that attains enlightenment. Thank you very much, my good friend, but I don't need to read that right now.
You made a comment earlier about something about working with super laws that are...
Yeah.
That's the superhuman.
Right, that's the Superman, right. The laws of the universe that you become aware of and can manipulate.
Is that why they could, I've been reading autobiography of Yoda.
Yeah, yeah.
But they could, they could show up to other people, or they see, they know when somebody's coming.
Because they understand and
they can materialize something.
And they know how to manipulate those laws that create that. So yes, that's why.
An ability or a knowledge that we, if we elevated our consciousness to a certain place, or I don't know how the right words are.
Yeah, that's good.
We come to someone that understanding of that part of us.
Yes.
We would understand.
Right. Well, you are fully realized, you understand all those laws, all those super laws, and you not only understand them, you can manipulate them to achieve objectives.
Because it's so not far out to those people.
No, it's not. Not at all.
But that level of awakening can come and go for people.
I don't know if that's true or not. I mean, it might be true, but certainly in the autobiography of Yogi, the people he talks about are people who have that as a...
They've
realized it, and that's part of who they are now.
Kind of once you see something, you can't not see.
Go back.
I would think it would be.
You said that once. I've known people who've gone back after amazing times.
Well, that would be a case of not full realization.
Right.
But it could be that if you achieve a certain level of a realization, you can do some of those things. I don't know. I have no experience with those things. Right. Right. Full realization means living there, being there all the time. So, yeah. So, through the power of meditation, we're able to transfer our consciousness from the body, the physical self that was born in water, through water, to the soul, which is a spiritually born element, aspect of us, where it can become one with the divine. Now, before departing from this topic, we should take a brief look at the question of how one learns to practice meditation in such a way that one can attain reunion with God. Yogananda, in the grand Hindu tradition, says it's essential for us to find and follow a guru, a spiritually enlightened person who is able to resonate with us spiritually. He says that, quote, a true guru is one who can change the disciples' brain cells by the spiritual current flowing from God through his enlightened consciousness into the devotee. This transformation, according to Yogananda, must take place during this incarnation. That is, it has to take place while we're here, not in the next, when we move on, make a transition. At death, he says, wherever one leaves off in his progress, he will have to start again in a new incarnation. All over. From where you are, though. You keep all your progress. And all your regress.
You keep progress when you die?
Yeah, you keep all your progress and your regress. You have to exactly where you are. Karmically, it's a continuum. Yeah, there's no backsliding. Or further sliding, for that matter.
So when you refer to as an old soul, it's something that's closer to achieving.
Yeah, it feels like that, yeah. Yep. After giving the subject much thought and meditative attention and consulting with others on similar paths, I've concluded that while a guru is necessary, it's not necessary that the guru be a living person. If the person you wish to follow as a guru is fully realized, then learning the proper path and techniques through his or her books, lectures, and other means is a perfectly legitimate way to find and follow a guru. At least that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Well, it makes sense, because it would be the transmission of, however it's transmitted.
Exactly.
Whether you're in the presence of a person, you're in the presence of a person through a book.
Question of what the medium is, right? Is the medium speech through the air, or is the medium words through the brain, through the mind? Yeah. And I'd point out, different people learn differently, right? And we learn this when we're doing teaching and training things, right? Some people, you could talk to them all day long and lecture, but they never get it. Let them get their hands on it and try it and fail a few times, and they got it. So.
There was a professor at one time that said, you know, if you feel a devotion to Christ, you go with it. It's who you feel you're supporting your devotion.
Talk up a little bit so I can get you on here.
He was saying to a devotee that this devotee didn't just feel as close to Yogananda as was in the organization. But he said, if you, where your devotion is, that's where your heart is. If you felt the devotion to Christ or Babaji or the Hare Mahashaya, that's where you go for. And sometimes it changes.
Yeah.
Another minister said one time, sometimes I feel closer to Krishna, sometimes I feel closer to Christ or Yogananda. So it changes.
Good. That's helpful information. Thanks, Keith. So that's the discussion of this first truth that Christians use misinterpretation and misunderstand. And I'm not ascribing any bad motives to them. It's just how things are. And they come up with the idea that in order to be saved, you must be baptized, basically. Any more comments or questions?
Where does baptizing come from? I mean, who?
Well, it was some aspect of the Jewish tradition, because Jesus was being baptized by John the Baptist in the River Jordan, and nobody said, "Well, that's weird."
And that was supposed to be when the Holy Spirit, you know, flew over.
Were Jews baptizing other people?
Yes,
they were.
Jews were baptizing Jews, but I never have researched this question in depth, but I remember reading something. There were only certain sects of Judaism that were practicing baptism.
Oh, okay.
And it was not baptism for the forgiveness of sins or anything else, and they were baptizing only adults as an outward symbol of their decision to become leaders in the Jewish community or active participants or whatever. There are lots of different sayings about that. I don't know, I've never looked at that, but I know it goes back to Judaism. And I think it may actually, there's actually evidence that baptism was a practice in the ancient Egyptian religion as well. Yeah.
Okay.
Only sometimes they baptized them and left them there.
Not in terms of original sin.
When John baptized Jesus, he made a big deal out of it. He said, you know, I'm not the one, this is the one right here.
Right. Yeah, John the Baptist was a bridge between the Jewish faith and Jesus coming. Any other questions or comments? Okay, so the next teaching that Jesus comes up with, that we come up with in terms of looking at these teachings of Jesus that are misused sometimes, is the notion that the path to divine consciousness is within. Now, picking up where we left off in the dialogue between Jesus and Nicodemus, Jesus is getting more than a little exasperated with Nicodemus by now. He says, so Nicodemus asks the question, how could that be possible? When he talks about the being baptized by water and spirit. And Jesus replied, you're a teacher of Israel and you don't understand this? As God is my witness. Oy vey. We tell what we know and we give evidence about what we've seen, but none of you accepts our evidence. If I tell you about what's mundane and you don't believe, how will you believe if I tell you about what's heavenly? No one has gone up to heaven except the one who came down from there, the Son of Adam.
So what does that mean?
Son of Adam. It's another phrase for the Son of Man, which means us, everybody.
No one's gone up.
Humanity.
There.
Son of Adam
is the same thing as the Son of Man, which is the, which is all humanity. All of us are. So all of us are the Son of Man. When Jesus uses the phrase the Son of Man, he means his physical self, in which he's not different from anybody else. When he says Son of God, he's talking about his spiritual self, his self-realized self, fully realized self. So he says, after he says, how can you believe, how will you believe if I tell you what's heavenly? He says, no one has gone up to heaven except the one who came down from there, the Son of Adam. The Son of Adam is us, all of us. Although that's where the Christian movement goes astray and decides that that means Jesus. That he's the only descendant, makes him the only begotten, right? That's part of what the problem is. After pointing out that the mere fact that Nicodemus holds a position of authority in Israel doesn't guarantee that he'll understand the mysteries of life, Jesus reiterates his earlier teaching that we talked about a few minutes ago, that most people cannot understand the deep spirituality behind his teachings. And he asks Nicodemus that rhetorical question, if I tell you about what's mundane and you don't believe, how are you going to believe me when I tell you about things that are spiritual, i.e. deeper? There we have that physical-spiritual dichotomy again. Despite the fact that he's frustrated here, Jesus goes on to try to explain to Nicodemus, in relatively simple terms, given the context, how this process of spiritual awakening works for all who wish to engage it. This passage, which takes up verses 13 and 14, begins with the word "and." So that indicates that we need, it's a continuation of the preceding thought, so we need to try to figure out what that connection is with the preceding thought. Jesus has just been talking about how to describe spiritual matters to the uninitiated and unprepared mind. And since he's been talking about birth and rebirth, he makes a transition from talking about the subject generally to discussing it in the specific case of the Son of Man, which he says is in heaven. Son of Man is in the King James Version. That got translated Son of Adam in the Scholar's Version. Same meaning. So he tells Nicodemus, nobody gets to heaven unless he first comes down from heaven. In other words, in the context of the present teaching, he's saying that being physically born is not enough. We must be reborn from above. Spiritually or from heaven, from above, as we talked about earlier. That was that flag. We keep hearing that from above flag, and that's important because that's the place at which the break with traditional Christianity comes. The baptism or the experience of being born from above is a spiritual experience, not a physical one. That's fairly clear.
Is there just one gospel that Nicodemus?
Yeah, John's the only gospel in which Nicodemus, the story of Nicodemus, appears. Yes. Well, he's in two or three of the non-canonicals, but he's not in any other canonical gospels.
Isn't Nicodemus a Greek name?
Nicodemus is probably no. I wouldn't.
Might
be a Greek name. I don't know, but he's a Jew here. Maybe he's a Greek Jew or a Jewish Greek. So, the next passage, he says, in the wilderness, Moses elevated the snake. In the same way, the Son of Adam is destined to be elevated, so everyone who believes in him can have real life. So what's with the snake?
Yeah, I was just going to ask you, what's the snake?
And that would have been, this is something that feels fairly mysterious to us, and it's one of the places that modern, well, that Christianity since about the 4th century has sort of stumbled around a bit. If you take that literally, what is this raising up of the snake about that he talks about, how Moses raised up the snake? And you have to go back to the Hebrew Scriptures, and in Numbers 21:9, Moses created a bronze sculpture of a snake and mounted it on a pole. whenever anyone in Israel was bitten by a snake, they could look at the bronze serpent and be healed. Now, the reason the people of Israel needed this particular serpent was because they had previously offended God, who, by way of retribution, had unleashed a large number of snakes who were biting and killing the people. When they repented on that behavior to Moses, Moses went to God and asks, "What can I do about this situation now?" And God says, "Make this image of a snake as a healing mechanism. Anybody who looks at it will be cured, will be healed." Now, that's clearly one of the strangest stories in Hebrew scripture.
Say, that's really in there somewhere?
It is. Numbers 21:9. You can look it up. Yep.
That's become the logo for the medical.
Yep, the caduceus. Caduceus, they call it. It seems so unlikely that a God who had recently told Israel that it could not worship graven images, right? First commandment. And that it was to have no other God before me, would prescribe gazing at a graven image as a way of healing a plague which he himself brought on the people. There is something incongruous about that.
What year was that, please? What year was...
Well, that was during the wanderings in the wilderness.
And is there a time period?
Yeah, it probably is, but I don't know what it is. I mean, I don't know off the top of my head. You could look. It's when the Jews were wandering after they left Egypt and before they got to the Promised Land. That 40 years. But that's not the point here. The point here is that Jesus is comparing himself, for this limited purpose at least, to that serpent. He's saying that just as the serpent became an instrument of healing on the physical plane, so Jesus should become an instrument of healing on the spiritual plane. Now, Jesus knows that Nicodemus, who's a leader in the Jewish community, will immediately understand the analogy, even though we don't. Further evidence, I submit, that the gospel accounts were not written for the 21st century. So it could, in that sense, serve the same purpose as if he told a full-blown parable about a snake being healing snake bites. But we could understand this passage metaphysically and get yet another level of insight into it. According to Yogananda, the word serpent here refers to man's consciousness and life force. The chi.
Is it kundalini?
Yeah, I'm ignoring you.
I'm sorry.
That was pretty good.
As they are subtly coiled in a passageway at the base of the spine. This life force is the embodiment and vehicle by which our physical bodies are made manifest.
The reason I was asking is because the snake... Pre-Columbian times, etc., those early classic, pre-classic times, was a symbol of fertility and rebirth.
Right.
And all of those kinds of things. That was one of the only things that could live under the ground outside. So I was trying to get a sense of it somewhere creeped in from one of those.
I don't get that from anything that I read, but that doesn't mean there couldn't be a connection there for sure. Yeah.
The metaphysical... I'm looking at the metaphysical meaning of snake. Healing, transformation, knowledge, wisdom.
Exactly. Yep. So he's saying that's the life essence of human being. It's the chi that makes us human, who we are. And as this essence ascends, in other words, it evolves through stages toward attaining enlightenment as Superman, it becomes successively lighter and increases its energy level. That's the meaning of lifting up the serpent. It ascends from the lowest chakra point, if you will, to the highest. That's the process by which we achieve enlightenment.
That's what's also called kundalini.
I'm still ignoring you. Yes, it's kundalini. I was going to make it a surprise, but I can't anymore. Yeah. So it's all related to kundalini meditation. So I'll get to a better explanation here in a minute. It's maddening teaching people who already know more than you do. But it's fun.
Well, we've been heard a lot about kundalini.
In certain parts of the help. They don't know everything.
Yeah, true. So even though this text has been used by Christians to suggest that just as the uplifted serpent on a tree in the wilderness saved Israel from the wrath of God. So Jesus raising on the tree of the cross and his subsequent ascension are the only ways to save humanity from God's wrath. Clearly has much deeper implications than that for one who wishes to search spiritually. That's particularly true when we view this teaching in the context of Jesus' Eastern mystical understanding and influence. Now recall from our last lesson that when Jesus used the phrase Son of Man, he was referring to his physical body, and by implication, all of those who have physical bodies. So in verse 14, when he says the Son of Man must be lifted up, he means all of us who have been born on the physical plane must ascend to the spiritual plane to achieve reunion with the divine. That's what that lifting up is about, must be ascended spiritually.
All of us?
All of us.
Together?
Well, that's what the Course teaches, isn't it? We all get there at once. In that lifted up or exalted state, we become part of the divine, reunited with God. The statement that everyone who believes in him can have real life. Everyone who believes in the Son of God, Son of Man, can have real life. To believe that, we must engage God in silence and meditation so that our infinite intuition is awakened sufficiently to receive that truth. Furthermore, we must reascend from body consciousness into God consciousness on the same path by which it descended from God consciousness into body consciousness. Now, Yogananda gets into some pretty heavy chakra stuff here if you read the Second Coming of Christ version of this material. I'm not going to get into it because it's a little too complicated and requires some pre-knowledge that I don't entirely understand myself. But if you're interested, you might want to pick up the book and read that part of the chapter. And if that really interests you, then you might want to pick up the 2-volume set and read that discourse. That this material is contained in Discourse 14. No, yeah, 14, right. You might find it interesting to know, though, that this metaphor of the life force is a coiled passage in its lowest chakra is also known in Sanskrit and Hindu teachings as the Kundalini, as has already been disclosed, or serpent force. Until it is activated and reascends, it's referred to as the sleeping Kundalini. Yogananda tells us that awakening this Kundalini force is exceedingly difficult and cannot be done accidentally without great concentration. It requires years of meditation under the guidance of a competent guru, but he says the rewards are great. He says, quote, one who is able to awaken the Kundalini fast approaches the state of Christhood.
Can I make a comment?
Please do.
It's just that with the Kundalini thing, okay, when it gets to the heart, that's the whole business, okay? I mean, like, if people have a little bit messed up down here, a little bit this and that, if the Kundalini is in their heart strong enough, that's what's the most important thing. I mean, it's not like every chakra has.
It goes further than that, though.
Yeah, but it goes to the crown, too. It's not like everything in between has to be perfect. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Those are the most important, too, the crown and the heart.
The heart, yeah.
Yeah.
Open your heart. Get you connected.
So how many of you have had an experience with Kundalini meditation?
I've studied it.
We're going to have some things to say to you shortly in there, Mr. Larry.
Everybody has to do their own work.
I had
open up your heart.
I had it in my heart so strong that I can't even put it in words in the last 3 months. So, you know, it's a big thing when it does happen.
Another form of meditation.
And I had to meditate my head off to get to that.
Your head's still there.
Well, I had to meditate my heart off.
Okay.
Well, I did. I had to really do a lot of meditation to get to that.
That's Kundalini.
For Yogananda, the bottom line is that Jesus explains that whoever, quote, believes in the doctrine of lifting the bodily consciousness is the Son of Man, from the physical to the astral, by reversing the life force through the coiled passage at the base of the spine, will not perish, but will gradually acquire the immutable state Christ consciousness, which is the Son of God, which is a reunion with the divine that we talk about as our primary goal. as spiritual beings. Any questions or comments on that section before we go to the last one? We're going to finish early tonight because you guys aren't very talkative.
Are you going to get Kriya Yoga at all?
Am I going to get
in
what?
This class?
No. I don't know enough about it to teach it. And he doesn't include that in this book.
I have more comments. Sorry.
No, don't be apologetic. Please do.
Right.
We'll be done at 8:15 if you don't.
Right. Okay, so I went through, so I got the guidance that all I had to do is meditate on Christ in my heart. That's all I had to do. I got that guidance day after day, but I didn't follow it because it seemed so simple. It seemed so... And then I started to do that, to focus every single day, meditate on Christ in my heart for about 3 months. And it was just unbelievable, the riches that it brought spiritually. I'm not there now. This was years ago. But it was a very memorable, beautiful experience of Christ.
Okay, thanks for sharing that. Michael, do you have something?
Oh, Harrison Ford didn't like snakes.
That's okay. I don't like Harrison Ford. Actually, I do, but I had to say that for my daughter's benefit because she's a huge fan of his. Yes,
well, she is.
It's interesting being in different churches the way I have. And once in a while, including this church, I'm going to say they felt some tingling. Here, I've heard that here, and I've heard it at West Haven, and of course, at Self-Realization Fellowship. So, it's not just something that, and West Haven was not a big meditative church, but somehow with their practices, their techniques, they can also experience that. So it's not exclusive to SRF, and that's what I feel.
Good, thanks.
Well, I would say the fellowship, Yogananda's fellowship, right?
Yeah, self-realization.
Does everybody there practice that Kriya Yoga type of meditation? Is that the type of a method of meditation?
Anybody that's gone that far. I mean, we have people that just come to the church and don't take the lessons.
Okay. So there's a...
But I heard one minister say, you know, when you start to feel the tingling up here, well, that's all there is. So, I don't know, maybe that's just how far you got. But I've heard that in other churches. I mean, I've heard a minister say for years, you know, then get up and say, you know, I went on the retreat and I started to feel a little tingling up here. So, that's when I started to connect. Well, it happens at different places.
But you don't say, okay, I got it now, and then don't practice anymore. You have to keep practicing if you're gonna hold on to it.
Mm-hmm. I would think there's more than one way to realize.
Oh yeah.
So many ways.
Course in Miracles says there's thousands of them.
Yeah, there's so many ways.
There's gotta be, because it wasn't just Kriya Yoga like thousands of years ago, was it?
Well, it's been handed down.
But people have other gurus, like Babaji and all that, and they use the same method?
Yeah. It was handed down from Babaji.
Yeah, Kriya Yoga came from Babaji, directly from the ancient rishis to Babaji to his disciples. And it's continued down that as the technique. But I think I read a note first week about that originating back with the ancient rishis and being practiced by Moses and Abraham and
the Kundalini that I practice was an open eye meditation, and some people don't like looking at other people in the eye for a long time, you know, for an hour or two, and that's what we did. I think it's for me, as long as I can disconnect myself from the person, you know, are not really trying to connect. You're not really trying to connect with the person by looking at them in the eye, I don't think. So I could do it for that reason. I wasn't trying to, and I have to connect myself, disconnect myself rather, because, you know, people can take you and jerk you around if you fall under their spell. That's what I say.
I see.
For me.
Okay.
Steal your energy.
Do whatever they want to do. If you, you know, if you put them on a pedestal, then they'll be there and they'll let you put them there. Some people. Vicky always says, always step down off of the pedestal, which I like that. That keeps
she
you humble. That keeps you humble to keep stepping down off of the. Yeah, but some gurus, I think, you know, like everybody, I mean, like, there's always a possibility that it doesn't happen that way, and so I'm cautious that way. Is that? Did you practice open eye kundalini?
Myself,
mm-hmm.
You know, I was guided to do it with my eyes closed for about an hour. That's what my inner guidance told me.
Well,
so I did that then. But the only time I had a really outer spiritual teacher was Eckhart Tolle, and I know people do put him on a pedestal, but he's still humble. I went to an Eckhart Tolle years ago here.
Practicing the presence of now.
Yeah.
That used to be here. The guy.
Yeah.
Michael.
Michael, yeah.
But you can do open eye, just stare at the wall. It doesn't have to be in person. But that particular one you were doing was somebody that had everybody with their eyes open on. Yeah. I personally don't like that. That just seems
Yeah.
In PG.
Vicky came a couple of times. I practiced for about a couple of years. And then Nicole dragged me out of it.
Well, that's another story.
Okay, that's another story.
Yes. Anything else on that subject before we move on? Okay, so the last of these core teachings of Jesus that we're looking at tonight is the notion that believing on his name will have some efficacious effect that ranges from getting you into heaven to at least meeting one of the prerequisites. I'm going to read you from John 3, 16, which you've heard lots of times, through 21. This is, again, the scholar's version. This is how God loved the world. He gave up an only Son so that everyone who believes in him will not be lost but have real life. After all, God sent this Son into the world not to condemn the world but to rescue the world through him. Those who believe in him are not condemned. Those who don't believe in him are already condemned. They haven't believed in God's only Son. This is the verdict on them. Light came into the world, but people loved darkness instead of light. Their actions were evil, weren't they? All those who do evil things hate the light and don't come into the light, otherwise their deeds would be exposed. But those who do what is true come into the light, so the nature of their deeds will become evident. Their deeds belong to God. It's probably safe to say that no other passage in the Gospel of John or in any of the canonical Gospels has caused more bigotry or difficulty than that of the notion that Jesus proclaimed himself as the only begotten Son of God. At its most basic, following the usual interpretation leads to the conclusion that Jesus was not in any sense a man born in a mortal body that involved his consciousness to become one with God. But that's the reality of Jesus' life and ministry as we know it. Born human, evolved his consciousness, became one with God. The same path all of us are on. Only by denying that humanity could reach the Jesus' humanity, could one reach the conclusion that Jesus was in any sense the only anything. So it wasn't unique in any sense. And he never said he was unique in any sense. From our metaphysical perspective, which is shared by Yogananda and, of course, millions of others, we can be certain that it's not the body of Jesus, but the Christ consciousness within it that was the only begotten. There is only one of us here, and there is only one Christ consciousness. We all participate in it, and we are all embodying it. It expresses in, through, and as each of us. Nowhere in the Gospel accounts does Jesus ever say that his Son of Man consciousness, that is, his human consciousness, or his body, is the only Savior throughout all time. In fact, it's pretty clear that from Judaic traditions that, and Jesus was raised in the Judaic traditions, that Moses, Abraham, and many others were saved even before Jesus was born. So to suggest that Jesus is the only way to salvation, the only begotten way to salvation, eliminates everybody in the Old Testament at the gate. Furthermore, each of us can free our consciousness from the case of flesh in which we find themselves and join it with the vast omnipresence of God simply by tuning in with Christ consciousness. That's all we have to do. But what could Jesus mean when he talks about those who did not believe in this Christ consciousness perishing or being condemned? It seems to me that what he means by that is that all these people find themselves in a place where their form is never transformed, where the delusion of materiality continues to dominate their lives, and from which they are inevitably going to face another incarnation in limited bodies that fall well short of the goal of reunion with the divine. And that's what the punishment is. That's what condemnation is. That's what perishing means, is you never get there. You're going to go through this again and again and again until you finally get it right. And then you'll get there.
There's not a maximum.
No maximum.
Seven or nine or something.
There's a tradition in Hinduism. There's a tradition in Hinduism.
Seven or something.
There's a tradition in Hinduism that says it takes 8 million lives.
8 million lives.
Oh, wow.
Now, I don't know if that's for everybody or for some people or the maximum lives. Or whatever.
That's for Michael.
There's no such thing.
And if there's no such thing as time. We could be doing 140,000 of them right now. That's right. Exactly.
Over and over.
That's
again.
Right.
The same time.
That's right.
In a different incarnation.
That's right.
All at once.
That's right. Isn't it fun?
Somewhere in the Yogananda's teachings, he says it's a million years.
Million years.
You don't know which one you're on. You could be on
the last one.
Yeah.
That's why the
Rishis
tried to find a loophole.
Yeah. Everybody's always trying to find a loophole.
Well,
Course in Miracles. Course in Miracles claims to be a shortcut to that path, too.
I mean,
that's the modern era. We're looking for shortcuts. I want instant salvation. I want it right now. I don't want to work for it.
Right.
I'll give
you
$50.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you know that story at W.C. Fields looking at the Bible and said, what are you doing? I'm looking for loopholes.
Yep.
That's
on his deathbed when he was doing that. Yep.
Buying indulgences. That was a good
one. That was a good one. Yeah, they had a good racket going there, didn't they?
Take off a few years.
fewer years in purgatory for me.
Well.
I found this description of Yogananda's particularly interesting in view of Vicky's fondness for the metaphor of our lives being like a movie. He said, God set the Christ intelligence to produce not a torture chamber, but a colossal cosmic motion picture whose scenes and actors would entertain for a time and ultimately return to the bliss of spirit. So we're just being entertained now.
Or we're entertaining.
And we are also entertaining. Not or, it's both.
I don't think
to the extent that we are actors in other people's dreams and lives.
I'm sorry, what?
To the extent that we are actors in other people's dreams and lives.
Right.
They've conjured up.
Right.
It's actually, it is entertaining to us. I'll admit it's entertaining because that's why I hang out.
Yeah, exactly, right, yeah. I mean, I've been to the other side, and I can tell you it's amazing, but I chose to come back here because I'm amused. I don't know. I'm entertained.
Well, you're easily amused.
There is that. It never seemed to me to be believable that God would condemn non-believers when he himself dwells in all beings. So if God dwells in all beings and God dwells in the unbelievers, he's going to condemn them. Isn't that kind of self-defeating? Rather, I think this condemnation and punishment originate within ourselves in the form of guilt, unhappiness, and a sense of aimlessness that characterizes so many people's lives today. No sense of purpose, bumping into walls,
bitter,
all of those fear, all of those things that come up for us on the shadow side of our lives are a function of not aligning ourselves and attuning ourselves with that Christ, that inner Christ consciousness that is the essence of who we are.
Trying to attune to the physical. Trying to get it.
Looked at from a cosmic perspective, we are all insane. Right? Because on the physical plane, if somebody goes around denying they're who they are, we put them in little institutions and we give them drugs. And we, right? So maybe we're all in a big institution and being fed drugs. I don't know. Because we're all crazy. Like the Matrix. Exactly like the Matrix.
That was a crazy.
Then we like taking drugs because it makes us feel like
that's right. Bad, exactly. Right? That's right.
I read it to meet him.
Yes, that's right. Or maybe we're all characters in a video game that God's playing over a console we don't have access to.
Oh, boy.
We don't know. Because we're not allowing ourselves to be in touch, in constant communication and touch with that inner Christ consciousness that keeps us grounded in the reality and the truth of our being as divine, eternal, spiritual beings. So as long as we're... any time we spend not in that place, we're spending in the material world, which is immaterial, a false hope, a false vision. It's exactly the same as a dream when we're sleeping, except we're awake having it. But how are we to begin to recognize the true presence of God and Christ consciousness within ourselves? We can begin simply by following the process of expansion that's inherent in the fundamental nature of the universe as an evolutionary space.
Say that again.
We can begin this process of recognizing the true presence of God and Christ consciousness within ourselves simply by following that process of expansion that's part of how evolution works. Beginning with ourselves and our families, we can expand to a point where loving all of humanity becomes a part of our daily spiritual walk. And we're going to talk a lot more about that next week when we talk about Jesus' teachings on universal love. As Yogananda says, one who disconnects himself from the happiness and welfare of others has already condemned himself by isolation from the spirit that pervades all souls. If there's only one of us here, and you disconnect from others, you're disconnecting from you. Yogananda says it this way. I'll repeat that. One who disconnects himself from the happiness and welfare of others has already condemned himself by isolation from the spirit that pervades all souls.
That's why on that walk in Washington,
there was felt like common, one, right?
There was a common openness. There was a common...
I call it a vibration.
Caring.
It was a vibration. Or it was all.
It was that connection that everybody.
Common purpose.
Yeah, there was a common. It was common.
You could feel it, then.
Yeah, it was amazing. It was amazing.
I sense it like a vibration. We're all.
Vibration is energy.
It is actually.
Yeah. Yep.
Well, you were all in that same energy.
Yeah, but we were all different.
And they're all creating that energy.
But we were all.
We're
all one. But yet we were all different.
That's the expansion, though, right?
Right, that's the expansion.
That's the connection.
People who don't recognize the presence of the absolute in their relative world, that is, the absolute in the world around us, tend to become either skeptics or dogmatists.
Or what?
Or dogmatists.
Anybody
who doesn't recognize the presence of the absolute in the relative world.
Did you mean dogmatic?
Dogmatic, yeah, but since it was a noun, I had to use a noun form.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So they become skeptical or dogmatic, or they become skeptics or dogmatists. A dogmatist is somebody who's dogmatic.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
The word for the night.
So how in the world did the whole true meaning of this only begotten son get lost anyway? I'm glad you asked. Because I have a whole section here about that.
Are you amused?
I'm amused. So, remember last week we talked about the use of the word in John 1 and how the word gets translated in a way by translators and modern Christians to mean Jesus. And it doesn't mean Jesus. It's not a... The noun word is logos. It has no gender. It doesn't mean he or it means it, and it means wisdom and knowledge. Well, the same as with the word, the only begotten son only came to signify the person of Jesus through a gradual evolution of doctrine brought about by complex theological and political influences. Going back to the first two centuries of the Christian church, the writings of many Gnostic Christians express an understanding that the only begotten Son is a cosmic principle in creation, the divine nous, N-O-U-S, which is Greek for intelligence, mind, or thought. It's also French for us.
It is.
Or we. Rather than as the person of Jesus. So there was a wide understanding about this in the first two centuries of the Christian movement. Clement of Alexandria, who's a very celebrated early church father, quotes from the writings of Theodotus, who's one of the earliest writers in the Christian movement, that the only begotten son is nous, the Greek word nous. Valentinus, a teacher greatly respected by the Christian congregation in Rome around AD 140, held a similar view, believing that, quote, in the prologue to the Gospel of John, the only begotten takes the place of nous. And along comes our favorite event, the Council of Nicaea. At the Council of Nicaea, and later at the Council of Constantinople, which took place in 381, the Church proclaimed as official doctrine that Jesus himself was, quote, the only begotten Son of God, begotten from the Father before all ages, light from light, true God from true God, begotten, not made. It's part of the creed.
Part of the creed that's there every day.
The Nicene Creed. They close every single door to him being anything other than the only begotten Son of the Father in that one set of phrases.
And you said that was political?
It was political and theological. I mean, the Christian movement was fragmented because, as I said, we talked about before, because there was this Gnostic movement, then there was this movement that from our historical perspective, we call proto-orthodoxy. At the time, it wouldn't have been called that. It would have been called mainstream or standard or, you know, this is where most of the folks are or whatever. And the battles at the Council of Nicaea and the Council of Constantinople and other synods and gatherings of a similar sort where multiple churches got together to talk about doctrine, the fundamental split was over the nature of Jesus, which was fundamentally a question of whether he was uniquely the Son of God or whether he was a man who became the Son of God. And the Son of God meaning, in that context, ascended being, an exalted, fully realized human being, but a human being. And I went over the options that first week, right? He was either all human who became a God, he was all God who never was human, or he was both God and man at the same time. Those are really the only options you got.
And they picked.
And the Gnostics said he was human who became God, and the mainstream said he was never human, he was always God. But he could manifest as a human because he was God.
But he was always God.
Right. That's why that's why this Nicene Creed goes on and on.
Well, really, we're always God, but we're not a realized God.
Right.
But he was.
That's not what they meant. They meant that, yeah.
But isn't that also a Greek God
Yes, it's a, well, it is an evolved Greek idea. I mean, it's historically,
right.
It wasn't early on in Greek religion or politics, but it became that.
Gods that could materialize.
When Emperor Augustine, yeah, exactly. In Greek myth, we had a lot of gods who could incarnate and then go back and not be, or they could come to Earth as gods and be visible as gods.
And pre-Columbian as well.
Yep, pre-Columbian teaching as well.
So what happened, so you're saying, when was the Nicene Council?
325.
Right, around there. So what happened to those Gnostics who believed that Jesus evolved in his...
Well, the vast majority of them made a decision either to leave the church, the Christian movement at that point, or to fragment it. A great many of them finally decided, well, I believe in Christ, I guess I'll follow these guys. But that's where the Syrian Christian Church, which became the Eastern Orthodox Church, came from. That's what the split was over that. And the Eastern Orthodox Church, to this day, maintains that original Gnostic belief.
It does?
Yeah. So does a Christian church in Syria.
Interesting.
So they didn't go away. They just got really small.
They're all blown up right now.
Yeah, they are. Yeah. Exactly.
Scattered, no pun intended.
Yeah. Now, the emperor enshrined these decisions about Jesus being God, very God from the beginning, in law, and he subjected Christians who did not accept that creed of Nicaea and its watchword, which was homoousios, homoousios, yeah, which means same substance, to legal disabilities. In other words, he didn't kill them, he didn't crucify them, he made them less than full citizens. He incapacitated them from a citizenship perspective. Took away some of their rights. Here's an interesting fact that just jumped into my head for no reason. There was a point in time at which anybody who became a Christian would refuse to serve in the military after 2 years. They were expected to refuse to serve in the military. After 2 years as a Christian, you were not allowed to serve in the military. If you did, you could be excommunicated from your church. That evolves to the point where eventually the only people who are allowed to become Roman soldiers are Christians.
What?
Yep.
Is that why the Romans wanted to take over the church?
That's right.
Oh!
Nailed it.
It's all about power. It always is. From that point on, the official teaching of the church was that to not accept Jesus as God was to reject God himself. Through the centuries, this view had enormous and often tragic implications for the relationship between Christians and Jews in particular, as well as for the non-Christian peoples in the lands later conquered and colonized by European nations.
That's still prevalent.
Yep. So in this passage that we just read from John 3:16-21, Jesus uses the word belief a couple times. But what exactly does belief mean? Well, the two dictionary definitions for the word, the first is an acceptance that a statement is true or that something exists.
Acceptance?
An acceptance.
Okay.
That a statement is true or that something exists. And the second definition is trust, faith, or confidence in someone or something. Now that term can apply, both definitions can apply equally here. Believing in your inner Christ consciousness says both that you agree it exists and that you have trust or faith in it.
So what's the difference between belief and faith?
That was a Sunday lesson once.
Was it?
Yeah.
There isn't any real difference between belief and faith.
Right?
That's right.
You have faith in it. You have belief.
That's right. If you believe in things, you have faith in them, yes.
I've heard faith is defined as belief in something for which there's no evidence.
Yes, I've heard that too. I don't disagree with that. You could refine the definition of faith to mean that. That's fine. Faith in which faith is belief in something for which there's no external evidence. But since here we're talking about the internal inner consciousness of Christ, that wouldn't apply because there's no external evidence of it either way. Mm. Belief is a point on the path of spiritual progress. see if I can say see exactly what Yogananda said about that belief is.
Something deeper than belief.
Belief is the initial stage of spiritual progress, necessary to receive the concept of God. So as a first step in spiritual progress, you have to accept that there is a God, a deity, a divinity. And to do that requires belief. So belief is the first step. But to be of real value in seeking the ultimate goal of reunion with the divine, that belief has to be turned into a conviction. Okay. Belief is a powerful force if it leads you ultimately to desire and even become doggedly determined to experience the true Christ. Yogananda says this is what Jesus meant when he urged people to believe in the name of the only begotten Son of God. Believe that inner Christ consciousness. It's a powerful force. It'll get you started down the path of enlightenment. But it isn't enough by itself. But what are the consequences of disbelief? Well, those who disbelieve, according to the passage we just were reading, are condemned.
Condemned to their own internal
condemned.
Hell.
Just says condemned. Fortunately, the same passage explains very clearly what it means to receive that condemnation, at least from the standpoint of us reading it today, although it hasn't always. There are no images of hell or fire or brimstone here. Rather, those who don't believe will not see or understand the light, by which is meant the all-pervading light of God, which lives within each one of us as an ever-present guide through discriminated intelligence and intuition. When we don't believe in the inner consciousness of Christ, we lose sight of that light. And losing sight of that light is the cause of what Christianity refers to as sin, and which we define as error of thought. Going beyond that, Yogananda says the origin of sin lies in the fact that the soul's divine intelligence and discrimination are suppressed by man's misuse of his God-given free choice. The misuse of free will. Making the wrong choices, making the wrong decisions. That's why we call it error of thought, because you can always change it.
It's like misuse of our attention.
Exactly. Our attention, our intention, our focus, our everything, yes.
You think it's like too selfish or something?
Well, selfishness is a part of that, but it's not all of it. Just making choices like to opt for the material rather than the spiritual realm, which all of us do almost every day, almost all the time.
Simple and so profound.
Yes. And that's what happens to people who don't focus on, don't believe in, don't put their faith and confidence in that inner Christ consciousness, is they just miss the light. Nothing bad happens to them other than the stuff that they choose to have bad happen to them. The punishment is self-administered and self-inflicted and self-felt. If they become self-aware that's what they're doing, then they can fix it, right? You can change the thought in an instant. You can change any thought in an instant. It's one of the nice things about thoughts. You can turn them on and off and change them at no notice.
What? It's like a grace that breaks into that. I think
sometimes that's what happens, is that people have an experience of grace or awakening or awareness,
like,
or be it different labels and different names.
That was my experience. I felt like it wasn't me.
You feel like it's not coming from you, it's coming from within that
within.
Inner consciousness, that inner Christ consciousness, right? But as I said before, belief is not sufficient. It's required, but it's not sufficient. Especially what we call blind belief. But Jesus' teachings went well beyond mere belief. To hold a conviction, one must have some personal experience or realization of the truth. Merely reading about it, studying it, discussing it, even teaching it is never going to be enough to break through to the deep truth of inner Christ consciousness that lies deep within us.
Why not?
Because it isn't. You have to have a personal experience that enables you to realize the truth as using intuitive judgment, which comes through meditation. All these other mechanisms will help inform that process, but you have to get to the place where you have that experience. Otherwise, you don't have any real evidence to support your contention. You're really relying on what other people are saying, however authoritative they might be, whether people's experience, however real they might be. If you don't own it, if you don't incorporate it, if you don't understand it and live it, it's not real.
It's almost information versus a knowing.
I call it knowledge versus wisdom.
Okay.
I know a lot of stuff about this. I don't have the wisdom to know what to do with it. As Yogananda says, quote, one can assert incessantly an intellectual belief in Jesus Christ, but if you never actually experience the cosmic Christ as both omnipresent and incarnate in Jesus, the spiritual practicality of this belief is insufficient to save you. So, we have to learn to believe. The first step is we have to learn to believe in God, in something, higher power, in deity, in divinity, in something bigger than us, with which we can communicate. And then we have to learn, through the elevation of our spiritual personal consciousness, our inner Christ consciousness, by a process of expanding our love and engaging in deep meditation, to expand and expand and expand that notion until we realize and embrace our oneness with all that is, because all that is encompasses God, and then we've achieved our reunification with God and where we want to be. But it starts with belief. Belief is not sufficient. Any comments or questions on that material?
So you go from belief is not enough. You go from belief to
conviction.
Conviction.
You said that you could just shut the thought off. I don't feel like I can do that.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand your question.
You said earlier in the conversation just something about thoughts, and that you could just turn them off.
Oh. No, what I meant was that if you are only believing because you've read about something or thought about it, so it's an intellectual kind of a belief,
yeah.
Those are really easy to get turned off by you reading somebody who's contradictory or having an experience that contradicts it. They get turned off. So they're not lasting data on which to base the foundational belief that's going to govern your whole life from now and through all eternity. Yeah, that was another thing I also said, yeah, was that the nice thing about thoughts is you can change them in an instant, any thought.
Oh, that's right, but it doesn't feel like that easy.
Then it's not a thought, it's a belief.
Okay.
A thought is something that you have in your mind and you think this is true, this is the case, and you haven't yet converted it into a belief. So thinking about God or thinking about what God might be like or something like that is all thought. Thinking that that it's okay for me as a human being to kill that person because he's different from me is a thought, even if I don't carry it out. I can change that thought in an instant. Because it hasn't become a belief. Then I can think, no, that's not right. And eventually that either one of those could become a belief, which is harder to change because it's also only a thought, but it's been held onto for long enough that it's producing other results. The thought held in mind process. Any other questions or comments? Yes. Regina? Did you do that? Okay, I thought you were waving at me.
I think she has a question or comment.
Nope, okay.
So would Yogananda say that that is it all about understanding mind? You know, is it like divine mind? Is God divine mind? Is that synonymous?
God is synonymous with divine mind. I think Yogananda would agree with that, yes. I don't know because I haven't asked him, but I believe he would.
So this whole process is about understanding mind.
It's about understanding mind, spirit.
Mind.
Not understanding. Understanding is the wrong word.
Not understanding, but realizing.
Having an experience of it and realizing it.
Yeah.
Realizing meaning internalizing it.
Just, yeah.
Having that experience that says, like with my resurrection experience, 500 people could say, you didn't have that, it wasn't real, here's a scientific explanation
but
for
you
it.
Felt it, so you know
it doesn't change a thing. I had the experience, I know it was real, that's what happened.
Yeah.
So they have the same kind of an encounter with the inner Christ, so that you have this experience of having a direct contact with that inner Christ consciousness. Nothing can shake that. That's the data on which to live, to base a foundation for living. The fact that you read 17 books about it by eminent scholars who all agreed on the same point doesn't really create that sense of foundational belief. It reinforces it. It can inform it. It can become the reason you're able to get the experience. I'm not discounting it. I'm just saying it's not enough.
It's a personal relationship of some sort that may be different for everybody.
Yes, should be different for everybody.
Maybe a felt perception of some sort, or it could be a seeing of light, or I don't know, a vision.
Yes.
Based on an experience, I think.
Based on an experience that takes place in your inner being, or is verified by your inner being. I mean, I've had a couple in the last weeks preparing for this course. I've really gone, something has led me way deeper than I've been before on some of the material that I've gone, I'm reading for the fifth time. I've gone way deeper. I've got, and I get messages that I think is my inner Christ consciousness talking to me. Mm-hmm. I always hear it as words. Other people get sensations or feelings or images, or there are lots of ways of communicating. But it definitely happens to me often enough that I'm convinced that there's a channel there. Mm-hmm. But I'm also convinced if I listened to it all the time, I'd be way better off.
But do you have any idea why you've experienced it more this time? Is it just from the repetition of your going deeper and deeper into it each time?
I think it's part of it's that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, any book that you read that's got real value content, every time you read it, you'll learn something new, even if you just read it last week.
Mm-hmm.
Like I read Autobiography of Yogi about every 18 months. And I always find something new in it. I find passages in there I swear weren't there last time I read it.
You weren't there the last time.
Exactly. Like, remember we were talking about that passage in John where Jesus breathed the Spirit into his disciples? I never read that before. But I've read it 100 times. I just never heard it.
Yeah.
Then I got it. Oh, okay, that's what's going on here. Sometimes, I think what Yogananda talks about and what anybody who's teaching Eastern, not just Eastern, any inner Christ consciousness-based teaching is telling you that pay attention, things get revealed. The more prepared your mind is to receive and understand truth, the more truth you'll get. Remember that passage that bothers a lot of people where it says that to those who have much more will be given, to those who have little will take away what they got? It occurs in a parable in Matthew. All that's saying is that if you have enough depth and experience of yourself and your inner Christ consciousness, you're going to get more of that. If you don't have any of that, you're going to lose what you got because you have nothing to hang on to. It's not a punishment or punitive kind of thing. It's a reality. It's karma. It's law, cause, and effect.
And it's not about physical wealth. It's about
inner... That's right. That's right. That's a parable that has a deeper meaning, right? Any other questions or comments? So next week we're going to conclude this 4-week mini class by looking at the last 3 chapters in the book. And the subject will be Jesus' unique and signature teaching of divine love. So we're going to look at basically the focus on divine, universal, unconditional love next week. And we'll wrap up with a re-examination of the starting point of this class And we're going to take a deeper look at the realm of God within each of us and how we find it and what it looks like and how we experience it. Namaste.
Well, that was great.
Thank you.